Our sin, my sin, is so profound that I found that even in the midst of trying to do what's right and good and noble, I turn around and at the same time, I see evil and sinfulness coming out of me.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
We're continuing in our series called Being a Christian, Understanding Key Biblical Concepts. And on one hand, that looks like such a cognitive process, but what we're really trying to do is understand how these key biblical principles really fit into the everyday walk of our Christian life. Last program, we talked about sinfulness. And this program, we're going to continue with the area of sinfulness. We were wondering if we had a lot more to say about this, but I think we do. Because sinfulness is such a big part of our lives, and it's hard to get a grasp on what exactly it looks like. Jack, one of the ways that sinfulness was defined for me early on in my Christian life was it was missing the mark. That doesn't really say it for me anymore, but it doesn't fill things out for me at all. But could you address that? And let's start at that place, because I think that's where a lot of people would, or how a lot of people would define sin now, is missing the mark.
Yeah, that comes from, I don't remember off the top of my head whether it's the Hebrew word or the Greek word that they're working from, or possibly both, where that's sort of the etymology of the word.
The start of the word, it's where it came from.
Yeah, it's the basic root meanings of the components of the word, and thus somehow suggested that maybe this word could be used for this kind of idea. But typically, etymology is not the way we want to get at the meaning of words. Because take an example in English: our farewell comment is goodbye. Well, if you go way, way, way back in English, what that means is God be with you. But nobody means God be with you anymore when they say goodbye. They're not aware of meaning that. They don't intend to mean that. It's not even any longer a part of the meaning of that English expression. It has evolved over time and been transformed into something else. So what defines what a word means is not its etymology. That is not its history, not where it came from. But at the time that the person is using the word, how does a user, a speaker of that language, what do they mean by the word at the time that it's being used? That's what a word means.
So hundreds of years ago, goodbye could have meant God be with you. But when we typically hear it today, it doesn't mean that at all.
Right, right. And so the same thing with sin meaning missing the mark. If they are right about the etymology, I haven't checked it out, I don't know, but if they are right about the etymology, even if it meant that the first time people used it, by the time we read the Bible, the word is being used with a much fuller and more developed and richer meaning than just missing the mark. It may have meant that at some time, but it doesn't mean that in the Bible any longer. And I don't think we gain anything by thinking of it that way. I have never been helped by that. I'm with you. It doesn't. There are just too many unanswered questions that it doesn't illuminate the concept for me.
And what it does actually for me is it keeps me from understanding how sin works itself out in my life. When I just think of missing the mark, it doesn't give me any real practical understanding of what sin is and what it looks like in my life and in the world. And that's what we really need to know, is not just something in our head, a definition of something to be able to say back to our Sunday school teacher or back to the preacher, but we really need to know how it works out in our lives.
Right. So, for example, missing the mark could easily be applied to a lot of the mistakes that we make.
You misbuttoned your shirt.
Yeah, yeah. I got my shirt buttoned wrong, or I went to pole vault 5 feet and I missed, and I went to lift something and I wasn't strong enough to lift it. I mean, I don't measure up. I somehow miss what I'm intending to do or supposed to do or ought to do. But so many of the mistakes in human life are not sin. You know, they just are not a part of my evil. They're a part of my finiteness, my frailty, my weakness, my smallness as a creature. I just can't do everything that could be done. I can't lift things can be too heavy to lift, too high to jump, take too much intelligence for me to get my head around. I mean, just all kinds of ways that I might miss. But sin and evil is a very, very distinctive and particular kind of problem that I have. It's not a matter of my finiteness and smallness. It's a matter of my brokenness. I really ought to be able to do some things that I'm not doing. And it's not for lack of power or lack of strength. It's for lack of goodness that I do sinful things.
So could we say that our sinfulness is a lack of goodness?
Yeah, I think so. That's a good way to summarize it.
Well, let's look at lack of goodness in context to the passage we were talking about in our last program. You were reading Romans 1, and Paul was saying that there's two ways that our sinfulness works itself out in our lives, two ways that God gave us over, really, to our sinfulness. One is through degrading passions, mm-hmm. and the other is through a depraved mind. We could do a short review on degrading passions. Why don't we do that now, and then go on and talk a little bit more about depraved mind.
Okay.
And what we're trying to do here, Jack, is take it away from, again, missing the mark. And degrading passions could almost sound like the same thing in the sense that they don't mean a lot to us unless we really define them better. We really get to the guts of what they're saying. And I think another thing we said in the last program is the way that Paul is talking there really fits his culture, and people would have got what he meant by his examples. But we need to translate that in a sense to our culture today and say and understand what a degrading passion is in the context of our culture, in our lives right now.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I did not emphasize last session when we were talking about degrading passions is the word degrading part of it. And I think it's important to understand what that means. Really, it means desires that we find ourselves given over to that make us somehow less than human. That is less than the human being that we ought to be, somehow lower as creatures than God made us to be. They really do degrade us. They really do, what's a synonym? They really do lower us.
It's like we're lowering the bar of what is really good.
Good and virtuous and acceptable human behavior and what it means to be a human being. We're lowering the
standard
of what it means to be a human being. Exactly. Yeah.
And we used a few examples of lowering the standard, but can we do that once again today?
Okay. The example he gives, of course, is homosexuality. There, in heterosexuality, other kinds of perverse desires that we have that really are degrading. I mean, they are only interesting to us if we are only animals. That's the only way in which they could be interesting to us. And yet, lo and behold, in our own lives and in our culture, we find ourselves fascinated with, intrigued with, interested in things that really, by all rights, a noble, decent, pure human being wouldn't even be interested in. But we find ourselves interested. Why? Because of this thing called sin.
Well, I think of very heinous things that I hear a lot in my counseling. People who are just so heinously abused. Groups of people watching perhaps a young child being tortured in a variety of different ways, cutting them, killing them, hurting them, massive forms of sexual abuse that's done to this young child, or watching animals, making them watch animals be hurt, or watching them watch other people be hurt. It's so degrading. It's so wrong. And yet, many people have a passion toward watching and seeing that kind of thing happen.
Yeah, and things that ought to be horrifying to us and ought to repel us are things that actually we find attractive. And that's a That's a serious, serious perversion of our human nature, of our human, of our humanity. It's degrading of our humanity. That's what Paul is saying.
I think on a lighter level than what I, the example I just used was, sometimes I have, it has felt good to me to finally get to somebody, to finally hurt them.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of grin on my face that says, good, I finally got them.
Yeah.
And that's just a horrible thing. I mean, I hate to admit it, but I know I'm not alone. I sit in a counseling office with people all the time knowing that this exists, but it's just awful.
Yeah. I every now and then I'll find myself on the sidelines of a soccer match where, for whatever reasons, a team as a whole or a player on the opposing team in particular has done something attitudinally or behaviorally to really get my ire, and I can find myself thinking thoughts like, boy, I really hope she gets it, or I really hope he gets it, or I really hope that team gets smashed, I really hope they get humiliated. That's exactly what you're talking about. Where's that coming from? I'm not responding to their evil. I'm responding to their excellence as soccer players even. They are so good, I hope they get smashed. Which is just perverse of me to think that the appropriate response to someone excelling at a particular ability or a particular skill, that my desire would be that they be humiliated, rather than standing back and with others around me going, boy, aren't they good?
Well,
aren't they amazing players?
Which is what a virtuous thing would be for us to do.
Right.
But where that comes from, Jack, isn't looking at them, it comes from you.
Right.
It comes from me. It comes from our sinfulness that we're really, really bent toward. I'd like to make a comment here that I think it's very important because, you know, in our culture, lots of us look really good in the United States. Here in Eugene, Oregon, there's a lot of people that look really good, you and I included, on the outside. We don't look like people who would be that way. I mean, that's what a lot of people might say. Well, gosh, I'd never expect that of Jack. But that's where we're really wrong, is we really need to expect that of Jack. We really need to expect that of Christine, not say, oh, that's Jack and it's no big deal. It is a big deal. It's wrong. It's sin. That's the very core of what we're talking about right here. But we shouldn't be surprised that is who you are.
Right, right. And the fact of the matter is, if you're watching on the sidelines, probably you wouldn't see me manifest those attitudes as readily as some of the other parents on the sidelines, because I know enough about what the Bible is teaching that we ought to be that I'm ashamed of that. And being ashamed of that, I hide that. I don't let it manifest itself. But just because I don't let it manifest itself doesn't mean that it's not there. And the fact that it's there is what is despicable, not simply that I manifest it, but the fact that it's there at all is really horrendous.
Okay, so someone could say at this point, oh my heavens, so I'm stuck. If I'm like Jack and I know it's wrong and I try and not do it, well, I haven't really gotten anywhere. I'm still just as big a sinner as I was before.
That's true. There is a difference between a believer and unbeliever with regard to these things, and that is, the one thing that's new and different for me in my life, having become a Christian, is that now I look at those things, and even if it takes me a while to get over my defensiveness, I can eventually say, you know what, that attitude is really degrading. That attitude is really subhuman. It's really perverse. It's wrong. It's despicable, and it's worthy of damnation. I can come on the radio and acknowledge that I am that and I am worthy of damnation. Why can I acknowledge that on the radio? Because I believe it's true. And God has convinced me in my heart of hearts that it is true, and it's true about me, that I am a person worthy of damnation if we're going to measure me by the standards of my goodness. I'm not good. That's new and different for a child of God, for a believer, is that they've come to a point where they're willing to own it and accept it and acknowledge the truth about their lack of goodness and what it deserves. Now, you were asking, Christine, you know, what if someone says, I'm stuck, if I'm like, can you repeat what you said, if I'm like Jack, then I'm a sinner, Well, if I act it out, I'm a sinner. If I don't act it out, I'm a sinner.
Exactly. Yeah, I used to be the person on the sidelines swearing at that soccer player and really thinking they were bad and not even noticing that there was something wrong with me in doing that. Now I realize that that whole attitude is wrong, so I swallow it. I try not to be hurtful toward that person, but I'm still a sinner in my heart because I want to be hurtful toward that person.
Okay, yeah. So what the New Testament is telling me is that there really is an advantage and a virtue and a kind of righteousness, and I'm putting righteousness in quotes, but there is a kind of righteousness that comes from not acting out, not swearing at that player, not verbally abusing them and verbally wishing them, cursing them and wishing them evil, because I'm not giving vent to that evil emotion, that evil attitude. Why am I not? Now, there's two ways that I might not give vent to that. One is because of another evil, the evil of self-righteousness, the evil of concealment, of hiding. I don't want to admit to myself, and I don't want to admit to anybody else that I am that kind of person, therefore I'm not going to do it. So I don't curse, I don't shout, I don't yell, and I pat myself on the back and call myself good. That's just evil all over again, a different kind of evil trumping the first kind of evil. But there is a kind of righteousness that sees my own heart, knows my own heart, strives to not act on the evil that's in my heart, but secretly inside my heart, I'm going before God and saying, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. God, I am a terrible person. Have mercy on me. That is the kind of righteousness that can be manifest in the life of a believer today, is that they do less frequently act on some of those evil attitudes in their heart because they're striving against them. They're fighting them. They're resisting them. They're not wanting to go where those attitudes want them to go. They used to shout at the person, curse the person, and if anyone called them on it, would defend what they are doing as just and right. They deserve all of my wrath, and how dare you criticize me for being wrathful toward them? I'm doing the right and appropriate thing here. That's sin left to its own resources and going with abandon toward the sinful attitude itself. The believer today will resist that and not manifest it, but he also won't pat himself on the back and call himself good just because he's resisted it, because he knows better than that. He knows that the impulses are there, and that's a sign of sinfulness and brokenness itself.
Okay, so then someone might say, oh, great. So all I'm left with is always acknowledging that I'm a sinner. I already know how bad I am. You know, I already feel terrible about myself, and that's what God wants out of me. He just wants me to know over and over again that I'm a sinner. I mean, it feels like I just keep digging myself a hole.
Well, in a sense, that's true. He does want me just to know over and over again how sinful I am. There's some truth to that.
So people are thinking, what does God want me to do? Keep on digging deeper and deeper into the ground and then covering the ground on top of myself? Why doesn't he just shoot me now?
Well, I'm not sure I'm appreciating the question.
Understanding the question?
Yeah.
What I'm saying, Jack, is that we're saying, what should we do with our sinfulness? Going back to the soccer game, sinfulness out and out is just going and cursing the player on the other team and thinking, that's okay, they earned it. Okay?
Right.
For me to say, to not curse them and to hold it in and to pat myself in the back and say, man, am I a great guy that I'm not cursing that person anymore. Boy, I'm wonderful, is also sin.
Mm-hmm.
But for me to say, hey, I would like to curse that person, if that's true, if that's really what's going on, and I'm not, but the fact that I want to curse that person just says that I'm a sinner. I mean, it shows my heart of evil wants to do it, but I'm recognizing that it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm left with is recognizing over and over again the sin that will inevitably come out of my heart.
Mm-hmm.
So a person could say, what I'm left with is just looking at my sin. Won't that just grind me into the ground? What good is that? Doesn't God want me to have some sense of freedom here? And the answer that I would give to that is absolutely. But the freedom comes paradoxically, very paradoxically, in the understanding that I'm a sinner. And understanding that that is the context in which I can appreciate and embrace and understand and really appreciate God's mercy more than any other thing, more than any other time, because I see the depravity of myself, and God's great love for me becomes just more evident in contrast to my sin.
Right.
And can I go on a moment?
Yeah.
And from a psychological health perspective, I'm not having to redefine reality. I'm not having to keep saying I'm not a person that's hurtful when I really am. And that's kind of the crux of unhealth, is I'm having to keep changing the reality of things so that I'm kind of torquing my mind around things that aren't true and then having to base my life on that. I become less and less healthy. So I don't have freedom there. I'm more and more in bonds to out of my unwillingness to address and look at and acknowledge what the truth is.
Become a slave of your self-deception.
Yeah, I do. That's a great way to put it, a slave of my self-deception.
Yeah, so the freedom that you're talking about is not freedom from sin. It's a freedom from condemnation, right?
Yes.
Because we don't be... That's what was confusing me about the question. It is true. It's just a reality that we don't become free from my sinfulness in this lifetime. That's a freedom I'm going to experience one day when I leave this age and enter the age to come. Then I truly am going to experience freedom from death and freedom from sin in a way that I am not free now. And if we don't like that, then we just don't like Christianity. I mean, we just don't like our faith. We don't like the gospel. But it's the truth. We're not free from my sinfulness now. But there is a sense, a psychological and emotional release that happens when we acknowledge our sinfulness, like you've described, if we understand the gospel, if we understand that there is mercy out of which God is going to respond to my evil. He's not going to condemn me. He's going to grant me an inheritance in the kingdom of God anyway. He's going to forgive my sins. He's going to find me acceptable anyway, even though I am thoroughly evil, and even though I don't deserve his acceptance, he's going to accept me out of his mercy. Well, that's tremendously freeing. But it comes from, and as you say, it comes only to those people who are willing to face into and acknowledge the fact that they're evil to start with.
And isn't it a paradox, Jack?
Yeah,
because what we do in our lives is fight so hard against seeing the sin in our lives. We become so dysfunctional. We become so pathological. We become so hurting out of this tenacity to hide from the reality of our sinfulness.
Right.
It's like we're going to die if we see it. And I think a lot of people, it is dying. It's dying to ourselves. That's exactly what the cross is about. It's looking at the reality of the sin in our lives and calling it what it is. That is what picking up our cross and carrying it means.
Mm-hmm. And I think we fight so hard, as you're describing, we fight so hard to not acknowledge our sinfulness, largely because, you know, something in my head says, if you're sinful, God won't accept you. So I can't dare allow myself to be sinful. I can't allow myself to admit it. I need to hide it from myself. I need to hide it from God. You know, maybe he won't look carefully enough and he won't notice. So maybe if I just present myself outwardly as acceptable, maybe he'll accept me. And we just fight really, really hard to believe that about ourselves and to try to convince God that that's the case. And it is so futile. It is so pointless. One, we're never going to hide it from God. And secondly, we're not acknowledging the mercy of God. My sinfulness is not in the end an obstacle. We see it as this huge obstacle because we don't understand that God is merciful. Well, if we understand that God is merciful, we understand that there's really no point to denying my sinfulness, because my sinfulness in the end is not going to prevent God from granting me everything that my heart really longs for.
Or Jack, I think, see if you can go with this one. I think for me, thinking that God isn't merciful isn't my biggest problem. If I really think about God, I understand his mercy far better than understand the mercy of the people around me when I sin. And that's kind of where I get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't expect that people are going to be merciful toward me If I sin and if I admit that I'm sinning, I really expect and have, of course, experienced, as everybody else, a huge lack of mercy on the part of other people. So I don't even get sometimes as far as God's mercy. I stop with, if I admit to Jack that I did this and this, then he's going to really hate me and or reject me or hurt me or at least not love me or not respect me or something. And so I'm going to hide it from him. But the problem is I end up not just hiding it from you. I end up hiding it eventually also from myself.
Right,
and
right.
I become more and more self-deceived.
Yeah.
But would you agree with me that you think that's really a bottom line problem for a lot of people?
Yeah. And I am my own. I am in a way my most important spectator. That's why we end up hiding it from ourselves, is because we think that I can't have any basis for respect for myself if I admit this about myself.
Yeah, you're right. I am my worst spectator, and I even use other people and what they'll think about me as kind of a guard against.
Yeah, exactly.
Looking at the fact that I feel really bad about me. And it's hard to live in my own skin.
And I think that's just a part of our evil itself. There's a kind of pride there. We can fully acknowledge that God is a merciful God who will accept me. And then something in me goes, yeah, but I want it to be better than that. I want to deserve it. I don't want to be accepted on the basis of mercy. I want to be accepted on the basis of worth. And so, by gum, I'm going to make myself worthy. And there's something perverse about that. I mean, there's just something so out of touch with reality about that. And yet, it drives us. And I think it's all tied in with, I want to think of myself as worthy. I want other people to know that I'm worthy. Everybody else can get to the kingdom of God by mercy, but not me. I'm going to deserve it when I get there. It's just this ugly kind of pride that drives us in so many areas of our life.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, is it looks so good, but the basis of it is pride.
Yeah.
And so have we really gotten down to the second area that Paul was talking about in Romans 1? Are we talking now about a depraved mind?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about, in a depraved mind, what we were saying last time we met was that we have wrong beliefs, attitudes, and actions. And this is an example of one of our beliefs that you just described.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it gets blurry to distinguish a belief from an attitude and a perception. But yeah, a false belief that we hang on to tenaciously is that we are basically good, for example. And that's all tied up with this attitude that we could call pride and arrogance. You know, there's a kind of inflated view of ourselves that is an attitudinal thing that comes very naturally to us because we are evil, because we are broken. In the kingdom of God, or the way we would be if we were created, if we were not broken and we were what God created us to be, is we'd be just innocently humble people. We would know that we were creatures. We would know that we have strengths. We would know that we have weaknesses. We would know that some people are better than us in some respects and not as good as us in other respects. And it would never occur to us to be envious of the strength of others and to hold in contempt the weaknesses of others. It would never occur to us to do that because we would just recognize that we are creatures. God has made us different, and we would accept those differences and enjoy our strengths and accept our weaknesses and just leave it at that. But in our brokenness, we have these attitude problems where we hold people in contempt when they are weak. And we inflate our importance when we look on and focus on our strengths, and we think we're the greatest thing in the universe because we are good at this particular thing or strong in this particular area of our humanity. Just completely warped view of reality. And yet it comes so naturally, and it drives most of our interactions with other people and the way we think about other people and the way we respond to them.
Jack, I think you've come across some really good descriptors here about our attitudes and beliefs and perceptions. So let me review just a minute and try and drive this home a little bit, certainly to myself, if not to anyone else here in the audience. When I feel small about myself, really what I do is I hold on to the contempt to the weaknesses of other people. I want to see them as less than myself because I already feel bad. I see that working itself out in my life and certainly many other people's lives in the area of criticism. And I believe that's where criticism comes from. People will often tell me, I really have a problem with criticism. And what that comes out of is a sense of feeling weak or less than or low. And so what they're doing is contemptuously looking at other people and saying that there's something wrong with them. On the other hand, when I'm envious of other people, or when I want to inflate my importance, that's where I wanted to go, when I want to see myself as better, I won't only be contemptuous, but I will and try and be critical of other people. I will have a distorted perception of myself as better than. It really comes out of a sense of weakness, but I'm coming out of this sense of, gosh, I really am doing this better. And so I'm kind of a better than person here. And I make myself envious to other people. I hide this reality of who I am, and I kind of try and put forth on stage, up front, on the big screen, the areas where I'm very, where I have achieved.
The cultural paradigm for that, as far as I'm concerned, is the Academy Awards. I just, whenever I see the Academy Awards, I'm just astounded that at the folly of this whole thing. People responding as if they are receiving the vindication of God himself because someone has said, you edited good, or you produced good, or you acted good in that film. And yet, they and a whole culture kind of encouraging that lets them think of this as being an affirmation of their entire being. Well, it's not that. But in a smaller way, we all do that, I think, with respect to ourselves. Because I have done well, performed well, am strong at this, I'm the king of the world. I'm the greatest. I'm honored by God himself for this very strength that I have. It's just a perverse attitude, a completely out of touch with reality attitude, an inflated sense of our own importance.
I'm thinking of an example in my life, Jack, and I hesitate to share it. One, because it's an area where I feel like I've grown, and I'm so used to wanting to, on this program, show my humanness and not let people think that I've like arrived somewhere. I want so much to relate to people and say, let's admit to the reality of our lives, and that's really where freedom comes from. And I think I may have already shared this example. So for those two reasons, I don't want to share it, and yet I'm compelled to do so because it's very encouraging to me to see this in my life. So bear with me if I've already said it. I've said before, as a counselor, I very much feel like a miracle watcher. And the reason that I describe my work that way is because I've seen such incredible things happen in people's lives. And I know, beyond knowing, that I just sat in that room and only did the best I could every hour that they were there. And most of the time I sat there thinking, I hope I can help them. I'm trying to do my best. What can I do here? And never convinced that I've always done it as good as somebody else could have done it. I'm just sitting in there muddling through it and really trying hard. A few days ago, someone came in and told me an incredible story of their perception of something awful that had happened to them and how they're acting on it. And I was just blown away by how good it was, by what a right choice it was, and how they could go in the opposite direction. They could really justify hurtful actions toward other people from the crime that was done toward them. And they're doing really right and good things. And I'm astounded. And they said to me, as people often do and have, I'm really thankful for you. We really appreciate your help. But, you know, anymore, I can't sit and say, oh, yeah, I know, I was really helpful. That's great. On one hand, I can. I was there trying my best, and I was there as a tool that God used. But on the other hand, you know, I'm just so humbled by it. I can't give myself an Academy Award because it wasn't something that I really did well, if you understand what I mean. I mean, I tried hard.
And you're just aware of how, of your own helplessness and how the real work was nothing that you could get done.
Not the real work. Yeah. Not that somebody's heart was softened and that was full of compassion and kindness. Somebody who was willing to perhaps say the truth in a place that was really right, or to stand their ground when they needed to rather than give in out of weakness. I'm however it looks, I'm just astounded by the goodness that I see sometimes grows out of people. And I'm really thankful that instead of thinking I should have an Academy Award, I think less and less I should have an Academy Award. I think more and more, how astounding that this has happened. How big that God is. And it's not because I even tried to get there. It's because over and over again, I've seen my failure, and it's got to be out of God's success that success happens.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the marks of our ongoing development as children of God, what the Bible calls our sanctification, is an increasing humility and gratitude toward God as we recognize that when all is said and done, I'm just a creature. I'm just the handiwork of God. God is making me. There's no reason for me to pat myself on the back. If anything wonderful is coming out of my life, it's something that I just watch. It's something, I like the way you describe it, it's just a spectator to miracles, not only in other people's lives, but in my own life.
Right.
I'm really kind of a spectator on my own life because I'm not the one doing my life ultimately. It's God making me, created me, in this case, recreating me.
I'm trying really hard. I don't want to give the impression.
Right, right.
But
we're not passive.
No, it's a very active process, but ultimately, as I try hard, what I mostly see is that I'm muddling up and sinning and doing it again. But what I do see happening out of this process in my life is, which may not be all that evident to everybody, but I am softening. I am feeling more compassion toward people. I do have more empathy. I really have a hard time staying a long time with condemnation toward another person. I can get real impatient with people and real frustrated. Like you and I were having a conversation the other day, and I was real frustrated. You're having this knowing smile. I just don't like that. Be nice, Jack. But ultimately, I've got to look at that situation that we were talking about and say, you know, given that situation, I would be doing the same thing. I am really bothered by the consequences of that situation on me, but, you know, that person needs compassion and I need to offer it, however that looks, and even have compassion toward you when I don't think you are doing exactly the right thing.
Right.
I don't agree with your steps that you're taking necessarily, but on the other hand, I don't watch your interactions in this situation. I'm not there every moment. And even if I was and I thought it was wrong, hey, if you watched me in lots of interactions, you'd think it was wrong too, maybe. So eventually, my point is, I end up not being able to feel real self-righteous very long about anything and have to come back to, hey, what do I know?
Right, right. You know? Yeah.
And it softens me towards you, and it softens me toward that situation.
I don't know everything. I can't know everything. I'm not omniscient. I'm not. There are just so many limitations on my life that we're willing to give other people a break based on no longer having that attitude of presumption that my perspective must be the only perspective in the world. My perspective must be the best perspective in the world, which we come by so naturally.
Uh-huh.
You know, just we just automatically assume that life looks the way it looks to me, period. The way life looks, God sees life the way I see life.
Yeah.
And if we stop to think about that, we realize how ridiculous that is. But we so seldom do we stop to think about that. We just assume that my perspective is the only perspective.
Yeah, man, I sure do that. You saw that the other day when I was talking to you. Quit smiling again. I'm really
just admiring your transparency.
I don't want to give other people a break. You know why? Because I want you to do it my way. Mm-hmm. I wanted you to stop that situation from continuing. I wanted you to make it stop, and I was going to tell you what was and try and get you to believe it. And that just comes out of a lack of humility. It was just sinful. It was telling you to change so that I wouldn't have to be bothered by it anymore. I'd still like you to change.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd still like you to see it from my perspective. But the point I'm getting at is I've got to give you a break. And I want to give you a break. I want to not come from the position that I'm just the standard of the world.
Yeah.
And that's hard for me to learn. So you threw up your arms. Like, what can you say? Yeah, Christine.
Well, no, I mean, what you're saying is very true. I mean, in that particular interaction, I said some things that were hurtful to you. And, you know, why did I say that? On the one hand, I could justify them that I was trying to defend somebody. On the other hand, and I don't even know. I don't even think I know myself well enough, but I'm very... The fact that they were hurtful, in all likelihood, comes out of the fact that even when we're trying to do something good and right and noble, we do it evilly. We can't even always do nobility right and virtue right. That we decide, how can I defend someone else? Well, I'll hurt somebody. I will try to disgrace them or humiliate them or do something like that. I don't think Jesus would have done that. I mean, he would have found a purer, more noble way to do it. I don't think God wants us to defend people by hurting other people.
And I think that's what you and I both did.
Yeah.
I felt disgraced and humiliated by the things that you said to me, and I was just going to come over that and tell you how right I was and how can you possibly think this way and not give you a break at all for the reality of what was happening in that situation. Right. Do you think that's pretty good?
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not even sure that, I don't even think I'm wise enough to sort out. I mean, you look at what Jesus did in his ministry. He said some really, really harsh things to people. But, I mean, you're sons of your father, to the Pharisees, you're sons of your father, the devil. You are a brood of vipers. You are whited sepulchres full of dead men's bones.
He was
just speaking the truth.
Yeah.
And I have to assume that it wasn't that he was speaking the truth at a time that it was opportune to tell the truth, that it was right to tell the truth, that it was appropriate to tell the truth. But I think there's just all kinds of differences between a morally perfect person saying those kinds of things and a morally imperfect person saying those kinds of things. The fact that that Jesus said hard things doesn't necessarily make it right for me to say the hard things that I say. Why? Because there's more to communication than just saying a hard thing. There's all the nonverbal language. There's the, you know, where is it coming from? That normally also gets communicated when we communicate. And if it's coming out of evil, then however true and right and appropriate and even opportune and timely that it might be, if it's rooted in a desire to hurt, it's rooted in a desire to lash out at someone, the other person experiences it that way, and that's evil. It's wrong.
Or even if it's not rooted in a desire to hurt, a conscious desire to hurt. I don't think at that meeting you were trying to hurt me consciously.
Not consciously, no.
But I felt it.
Yeah.
I felt it really big time. And it went later when I talked to you, it wasn't rooted in the desire to hurt you back. But nonetheless, both of us are rooted in sin, and
right.
We did hurt each other. So whether or not we intended to, I think we've said this before, but whether or not we intended to, we did hurt each other.
Yeah, and that's what we're driving at here, is that that's how profound sin is. That, you know, even as you and I sit here, I'm not sure either of us in a position to really pinpoint, okay, where did I cross over the line from doing something noble and good and right and appropriate, because both of us had that involved in what we were doing.
Absolutely.
But where did I step over the line and it actually become rooted in evil? I don't know. You know, I don't know if I could ever pinpoint that point. But I'm so convinced that what the Bible says is true, that no one is good, not even one, that it does not surprise me at all that what was being manifest in the way I was interacting was evil, was sin, was perverse, was a depraved mind at work. That's what was going on. And I even if I cannot articulate exactly how and why, I'm convinced that it's true.
Okay, so can I take this example a little bit further? This is the true confessions of Jack and Christine.
Yeah.
but I think it's a good example, and it's real present with us. This situation really is real, and it happened, Wednesday?
Yeah, last week.
Okay. I could tell you where I was wrong, and I was wrong, and I feel badly about it, that. I wish I hadn't done that, Jack. But your response to me is really good. I don't have this sense of judgment or hurt, and you're accepting your responsibility for your part. But it could be, and very often is, when I say that I'm wrong, or when we as people say that we're wrong, the response we get isn't as gracious. And so we could say, how can I possibly do that? And I think that's really where it's very much more difficult. And that's much more often what occurs. And it's hard for me to say, I guess just the point I'm making, it's hard for me to say I'm wrong when someone says, yeah, you're wrong, mm-hmm. and I'm going to grind it into you. And this, I'm pointing my finger at Jack and mm-hmm. saying how bad you are. And you don't come back and say, hey, I was also a sinner. To be able to stand my ground, I have to be able to tell myself the truth. The truth is that I'm a sinner. And the truth is that even if Jack had not been merciful to me, God is. And it's got to matter to me what God thinks. In the midst of people not being merciful to me, it can't be my honesty with myself and to other people can't be based on their response to me. It has to just be me hanging on to the reality of this truth that God is a merciful God. And that's what matters.
Yeah, that's good. That's really true. And I must not be intimidated by other people. Truth is what God declares to be the truth, not what other people declare to be the truth.
Well, I might feel intimidated, Jack.
Yeah, oh,
but
sure.
Ultimately, I must not act in a way that just is out of cowardice.
Yeah, I must, out of my intimidation, I must not allow their view of reality to become my view of reality. Because often what happens is, you know, you acknowledge that you'd be wrong, and I say, yeah, and that's what I've been telling you all along, you were wrong, and I'm not wrong. Well, the truth is, I mean, what I'm trying to do is to lay all the blame on you and accept none of the blame myself. Well, the truth is that that's not the case. The truth is that we are both evil and that we both have a part to play, we both had a role to play. You can believe that about me, even if I'm trying to intimidate you into not believing that about me. And that's important. I think in some relationships, that becomes a very, very crucial piece. That
No, that's not important. That's extremely, very
important.
Vitally important.
Yeah.
And why so? Let me let you continue.
Well, ultimately it comes down to who is the author of truth? Who sets the standard for truth? A controlling wife or husband? A parent? No, they're not the author of truth. It's God who's the author of truth. And even if I cannot in the relationship get them to see the truth, I must believe the truth about them, even if they don't believe the truth about themselves.
So what we're saying is both a spiritual reality and a psychologically healthy path to take is to see I'm a sinner and to see you're a sinner.
Right.
It is not my job to convince you of your sin, though.
Right.
I need to not do that, to not demand that of you. But I also need to stand on the truth here. Otherwise, I really am digging myself a hole of condemnation, and I can put the dirt over it and say, I'm the only bad person in this world. And psychologically, that really runs havoc on a person.
Drives you crazy.
It does.
Yeah.
So I need to look at the truth about myself. I'm a sinner. And I need to look at the truth about you. That you're a sinner, and we're both in this dance of sin together, and that's just the reality of it.
Yeah.
The staff of McKinsey Study Center has written a book on interpreting and understanding the Bible. It is what they call a common sense approach. They believe the Bible communicates God's wisdom to us in normal human language, and this requires us to be good readers. This also means we need to see each of the biblical authors as trying to communicate a particular set of ideas to a particular audience. But this is not always easy. In fact, it's hard work. What is needed is a set of godly principles to guide us in our interpretation. The authors of Biblical Interpretation, A Common Sense Approach, offer a reasonable guide to those principles. Call McKenzie at 541-485-4801 to order your copy.
So today, Jack, we've taken the theory of sinfulness to a personal understanding of sinfulness. When you and I talked about our sinful approach to each other in a meeting that we recently had, it's hard in our culture around other people to admit that we're sinners, to admit not just that we're sinners, but the context in which we sinned, the reality, the specific things that we did to sin toward one another. It's really hard to admit that. I don't want to, because I don't want to see myself as anything but a very clean and upright person. I really have that in me. It's a prideful thing that wants me, that drives me to say, hey, I'm pretty good. At least I'm better than you.
And although we have tried to make it as clear as we can from our own lives and our own circumstances to make it clear what it means to be a sinner, I'm really convinced that in the end, the only way I can learn what it means to be a sinner is from my own personal experience. I mean, the listeners to this program, they're going to have to learn that themselves through life circumstances as God works with them and deals with them. You know, we've tried to point them in a direction. We've tried to suggest what kinds of things to look for to come to an understanding of what the Bible means to call yourself a sinner. But it's when I feel the powerlessness before, when I feel myself having a choice to make, to courageously do the right thing or to treacherously do the wrong thing, and I flip and treacherously do the wrong thing, even though I know good and well that I should have done the other, that's when I really understand what it means for me to be a sinner, when I experience it within myself.
Or maybe when I look back on the situation, as we both did in the situation we were talking about, and say, ah, I flipped from doing what I thought was good, and part of it was, to doing what was wrong, and facing into, am I going to admit at this point,
right,
am I going to be willing to see myself not as white as I want to, but have some pretty significant streaks of black in the core of my being.
And you put your finger on the crucial thing, am I willing to see it? If I'm willing to see it, God is able to teach me. But the thing that's going to keep me from seeing it, and the only thing that's going to keep me from seeing it, is if I just absolutely refuse to let it be true about me. But if I'm willing to acknowledge that it's true about me, if I'm willing to accept it as real, there's going to be plenty of evidence that I'm going to learn from, and I'm going to come to understand through experience what it means to say that I'm a sinner.
And the paradox is, in recognizing that, in finally taking the hit, so to speak, seeing that I'm wrong, out of that is freedom.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.